Welcome to Oncology Today, a special follow-up program to two recent CME satellite meetings at the recent GI Cancer Symposium in San Francisco. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this first interview, I met with Dr. Zev Wainberg from the UCLA School of Medicine. To begin, I asked him to provide a general overview of the management of localized gastroesophageal cancer. So if you think about, I guess the extremes of the clinical presentation, you have esophageal squamous cancer, you have GE junction cancer, I guess usually adenocarcinoma, and then you have gastric cancer. So at least in my mind, I think that's kind of how clinicians begin. But when you're sort of sorting it out, how do you think through location, histology, and then what you're going to do in terms of neoadjuvant and post-neoadjuvant treatment?
Yeah, so esophageal squamous, esophageal adeno often present in similar clinical ways. They present with obstructions. They present with, you know, dysphagia, dysphagia, weight loss, lower chest pain, upper abdominal pain. Whereas gastric cancer, true gastric body cancer, really presents a little differently. It's more associated with weight loss, gastric outlet obstruction, early satiety, those kind of clinical symptoms. So there are some subtle distinctions between how these two cancers manifest and get to the GI doc. And then GI doc obviously has got to find the diagnosis and make the diagnosis correctly. When we're approaching it from a localized fashion and they completed their staging and they're, okay, they're non-metastatic, let's call it, whether you want to call it, someone who's resectable right now, or you want to call it someone who could be resectable, we know at least they're non-metastatic. And those patients usually are either launched on a path of neoadjuvant chemoradiation, and I believe personally that's still the best approach for tumors that are at or above the GE junction. And anything below, and below the GE junction, predominantly stomach tumors, I still think the standard of care there is neoadjuvant chemotherapy with FLOT. So, you know, the dividing line for me is still somewhere midway through the GE junction, recognizing that this is usually a multidisciplinary discussion, recognizing that there's a lot of opinions in either side of the direction. I usually use that as the dividing line, and patients above it, I generally prefer neoadjuvant chemoradiation with carbotaxol.
To what extent does histology affect your approach to this situation?
You know, histology doesn't affect it insofar as it doesn't trump staging. For example, in patients who have a T1 or T2N0 adenocarcinoma of the esophagus or squamous cell carcinoma of the esophagus, those patients are resected. I mean, there's no real data and no real value, if you believe in your clinical staging at least, to give them neoadjuvant therapy. Where it gets a little sticky is in these circumstances where it's a T2N0 or T3 and early T3N0, which is a lot of times what the GI endoscopists will give us. And on those terms, truthfully, I do tend, if it's a T2N0 that's, you know, subjectively symptomatic, I tend to give a lot of those patients neoadjuvant as well nowadays with either neoadjuvant chemoradiation or chemo. Yeah.
In terms of esophageal cancer, in terms of how you manage those patients, again, does histology matter?
Not insofar as neoadjuvant or perioperative approaches, Neil. It really, histology comes down to a little more in the metastatic setting. And so in the circumstances of local advance, it's still cross, it's still adjuvant nivolumab, independent of histology.
Okay, so I think somewhere along the way, probably even at diagnosis, or you tell me what your typical biomarker workup would be in a patient with localized disease.
I mean, so with localized disease, to be fair, a lot of the biomarker stuff is, you know, it's interesting, it's academic, we don't have drug approvals. So, to be honest with you, it doesn't really change the management that much. And you know, to be real practical here, I like getting the biomarker stuff because I think it's really important, particularly MSI high. That is the distinction. I would say if a patient is localized gastric cancer or even localized GE junction adeno, because in squamous cell it almost never happens, but those two, I do think it's important to know that. And I do think those patients ought to be treated with immunotherapy from the get-go. With the exception of that, and that includes HER2, and that includes CPS score, and that includes whatever other stuff we're going to talk about, it doesn't have, at this juncture, any practical implication for treatment. We collect it because, in practical terms, sometimes it's easier to collect it and have the data later for when they recur.
I would think a PD-1 assay would be something you'd want to know. Maybe it's not going to change what you do, but it seems like it'd be relevant. You tell me.
So at the moment, we don't have any use. We don't have any data to support the use of neoadjuvant Pembro, Nevo, any of the PD-L1 inhibitors in the neoadjuvant context. So I don't use it even if they do have a high PD-L1 score personally. I don't see how that would necessarily change their clinical outcome. That may change. All these trials are ongoing. I may say something totally different to you 6 months from now. But I think standing here right now, I like getting the data, as I mentioned, but even if they have a high PD-L1 score, I'm not sure. I am not going to use neoadjuvant Nevo or Pembro yet.
Okay. And then in terms of post-op management of these patients, both the patients who get across chemo radiation as well as the patient who gets a FLOT, how do you approach that?
So in cross patients, we have the CheckMate Data 577 study. We have a clear and a role for adjuvant nivolumab in patients who have had chemo radiation surgery and have some residual disease. Those patients, it's an absolute, in my opinion, unless there's a contraindication, good reason to give them Nevo. And that's independent of squamous or adeno, and that's independent of PD-L1 score, in my opinion. Might work a little better if they have a high TPS score. Might work a little better if they have squamous cell. But it doesn't mean you would withhold it in the context of adenocarcinoma of the esophagus. For patients with stomach cancer who commit to neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and that's times FLOT, the current standard is to continue that FLOT after surgery if they need more FLOT. It's not to change the chemo. It's not to add immunotherapy at this juncture. We're waiting for very, very big studies that may change that paradigm, but as of now, that's where we are.
So just kind of curious in terms of the use of adjuvant Nevo after the cross regimen, what kind of data do we have on PD-1 negative patients?
They already use primarily TPS score, so I don't want to make it confusing, but let's consider them PD-L1 negative. In the adenocarcinoma PD-L1 negative patients in particular, there wasn't as much benefit with adjuvant Nevo there compared to placebo, to be fair. In squamous cell, it's a different story. In squamous cell, which made up about, if I recall, 75 or 70% of the patient population in that CheckMate 577 study, even in the PD-L1 low patients or TPS low patients, there was benefit to nivolumab. So I think that the numbers end up being a little small in that context with the adenocarcinomas only. So therefore, in that context, and certainly when we're talking about, you know, a potentially curative scenario, I do practice and give it to those patients regardless of PD-L1 score. I feel a lot better about it if they know they're TPS positive or high.
Where do we stand in terms of trials looking at post-FLOT use of IO?
Yeah, so there's actually some data sets that have been, one data set, large data set out of Asia, surprisingly was announced to be negative, which I believe was one of the attraction studies, attraction 5, which looked at after patients who had gastrectomies, chemo plus or minus nivolumab did not meet its endpoint. It's a public announcement. We don't have the fine details. I'm sure we'll see that soon. That does make me a little concerned, theoretically, that the concept of adjuvant chemoimmunotherapy may not hold as well in gastric cancer as it did in esophageal cancer. That being said, the next wave of studies is very different because they looked at it neoadjuvantly and adjuvantly. And there's two large ones that are waiting for the data, at least two to my knowledge. One is a Keynote 585 study, which adds pembrolizumab to FLOT, or I should say any perioperative chemotherapy, mainly 5-FU platinum-based. There was some patients getting FLOT on there. And the other one is Matterhorn, which is a durvalumab-based study, which added durva to FWAT chemotherapy exclusively. So those two trials and maybe others that I'm not aware of will answer the question a little more.
And that's neoadjuvant IO or post-neoadjuvant IO?
They give it both. So they give it with the chemo neoadjuvantly, and then they give it adjuvantly. In some studies, it's a period of 6 months, and some it's a year, but it's essentially continued at the completion. They get the eight cycles of FWAT, which is four cycles, but 4 months of FWAT, basically, and then continuing on the immunotherapy on the back end for another 6 months to a year.
That's what happens in triple negative breast cancer. Okay, let's switch over to metastatic disease, first line therapy. Again, the same model of the three locations and how you think it through.
Okay, so squamous cell of the esophagus, metastatic disease. We have three options that I would consider reasonable at this juncture. Number one, chemotherapy plus immunotherapy, which includes either chemo plus Nivo based on CheckMate 648, or based on Keynote 590, FOLFOX, or 5-FU base chemo with pembrolizumab. Both good options, both clearly benefiting patients in squamous cell of the esophagus, particularly those with PD-L1 high, and particularly those who have high TPS scores as well. Now, so you also have a third option, which is ipi-nivo. And ipi-nivo also is a good option, in my opinion, and based on CheckMate 648, in squamous cell exclusively. So those are the three standard options. Someone has metastatic squamous cell carcinoma. How people go about it, which one they choose, it's clinical context determining these factors by and large, not so much the data sets we have. But those are the three options that most people prefer.
And how about adeno of the esophagus?
So out of the esophagus, it's a little, you know, they're bunched in with the gastric cancers predominantly. You've got primarily an option with chemo plus Nivo based on CheckMate 649, which included adenocarcinoma of the esophagus. You've also got an option of Keynote 590, which is, as I mentioned, chemo plus Pembro. So those are the two main options. Now, that's where the CPS score, in my opinion, matters a lot more than in patients with squamous cell. In squamous cell carcinoma of the esophagus, while PD-L1 score predicts benefit, the prediction of benefit is much stronger in squamous cell than it is adenocarcinoma, if that makes sense. So what I mean by that is that the CPS low patients don't get as much benefit from these checkpoint inhibitors in adeno, whereas in squamous there is a little more benefit.
What about, let's bring in gastroesophageal and gastric cancers, first line.
Okay, so gastric cancer, first line, and HER2 negative. The dividing line for me is still CPS 5. If you have a CPS greater than 5, in my opinion, the data is strong, and the survival and hazard ratios are clearly beneficial for chemo plus Nivo. The CPS less than 5, in my opinion, despite having an FDA approval, I just don't use it there. So I'm personally in that, I use CPS 5 as the dividing line. Now, the situation is dependent a little bit on your comfort level with the CPS diagnostic that's been obtained. Your situation is comfortable not offering immunotherapy to that patient. And so it really depends on individual characteristics. Now, to add a level of sort of complexity, which we try not to do, Neil, but as you mentioned, this is a complex situation, this disease. There was a presentation last week on an ESMO virtual of the Keynote 859 study, which by and large, if you just look at the totality of it, was a very large study, upwards of 1,500 patients. They more or less mirrored, in my opinion, what we saw in CheckMate 649, which is that there is a benefit of survival in the all-comer patient population. However, the hazard ratios and survival improvements are significantly better as we go up in the CPS, such that one might expect that just like in CheckMate 649, the patients with CPS 1 through 5 did not garner benefit. But we haven't yet seen all the details in that respect. But what we saw with KEYNOTE-859 is, in my opinion, a very, very similar study to what we saw with CheckMate-649.
And again, what about metastatic first-line therapy, carcinoma of the GE junction?
Those are bunched in with gastric cancer. So GE junction adenocarcinoma is always pretty much included on any gastric cancer study. So there were about a third of patients or so in the CheckMate 649 who had what was characterized as GE junction, a little less so in the KEYNOTE-859 because that was a primarily Asian study where GE junction is a little less common than gastric cancer. But by and large, I think the data is extrapolatable to both of those circumstances.
So would it be accurate to say that when you look at gastroesophageal cancers, metastatic, first-line therapy, that in general, if you have a patient that has a squamous cell, which is going to be esophageal generally, they should get an IO regardless of PD-1. And for people who are non-squamous or adeno, is question mark, and in your case, you feel that these people in general should not get it unless your CPS is 5? Is that sort of your algorithm?
That summarizes my opinion very well. Yeah. You do know, Neil. I would say that that's a subject of great controversy. Others believe that everybody should get NEVA.
But then if you sort of look at it from that more global point of view, I guess the other question is going to be, where is zolbetuximab going to fit in? And I was having this weird thought that PD-1 and Claudin 18.2 maybe is going to start to become like ER and HER2 of breast cancer. Like you're going to need it on everybody with metastatic disease. Is that the case?
Yeah, I agree. I think we'll be in a position probably in a year from now or so where we'll definitely want that information and we should have it. And you're absolutely right. It's a positive study in overall survival. So, you know, by definition, I think we should try to get that information.
So let's talk a little bit about zolbetuximab. Could you summarize a little bit your own view of the agent, how it works, and what we know about it so far in terms of efficacy and tolerability?
So it's a first-in-class monoclonal antibody blocking Claudin 18.2, which is a protein that is overexpressed, we use that term in this context, in about 30% of gastric cancer and some other cancers too, by the way, a little bit of pancreas, a little bit of squamous carcinoma of the lung. But what's unique about Claudin 18.2 as an adhesion molecule is that it's present in normal tissue, but only in the stomach mucosa, such that the stomach mucosa by far has the only normal expression of this antigen. Now, a number of years ago, probably even a decade ago, this was identified as an interesting target. And even in the TCGA data sets, there's a group of patients that are suggested to be Claudin 18.2 positive. A private company in Germany did what's called the FAST trial, which did a randomized phase 2 trial that plus chemotherapy plus or minus zolbetuximab in Claudin 18.2 positive. It was a positive study from a phase 2 perspective, met its progression-free survival and overall survival endpoints. Astellas acquired the drug, launched this randomized phase 3 trials, two randomized phase 3 trials, Spotlight and Glow. Spotlight was just presented now at GI ASCO and reported a 2-month or so improvement in overall survival in the group of patients who got zolbetuximab compared to chemotherapy plus placebo.
But also, in terms of hazard rate, my recollection is for progression-free survival was like about 0.75, but also survival, I think, was about, which is kind of unusual, about 0.75. Yeah. And both of those are pretty decent numbers, particularly the survival. Although it's kind of, I mean, to me, it seemed a little unusual to have them show up at the first analysis like that. You don't see too many trials like that. But any other thoughts in terms of the granularity, in terms of what we know about the responses and the efficacy data?
I mean, I think there's a lot of granularity here, actually. Number one, it was a huge effort. And we have to keep in mind that they screened something like 2,000 patients or so to get 500 patients or so. and randomize them into two groups, because you have to remember that it was a central screening effort that looked specifically for this biomarker, which is fairly proprietary. It's not an easy thing to do in any of our institutions. It's centrally checked. And then they reported back the information to the investigator. So we're talking about a fairly selected group of patients already, number one. Number two, there was no increase in response rate in the group of patients who got chemotherapy plus zolbetuximab over chemotherapy plus placebo. And that's interesting. I thought it was interesting. I think there's scientific reasons why claudin 18.2 antibodies don't confer response rate, having to do with perhaps the mechanism of action of the protein. And to some extent, it's not a signal transduction type of drug. It's an adhesion molecule. So one might not necessarily expect an improvement in response rate. That being said, the primary endpoint of the study was progression-free survival. And so they did meet that, and coinciding with that, you're absolutely right, was the secondary endpoint of overall survival, which is a bit unusual that they would both happen at the same time, but I think speaks to the fact that the drug does have significant activity in that select group of patients. Now, we're not used to seeing in gastric cancer any circumstance where a drug that doesn't improve response rate has a corresponding improvement in PFS and OS. That's not been the case with the HER2 inhibitors. That's not been the case with the PD-L1 inhibitors. So there's something quite different in this regard.
What about tolerability issues? You mentioned the fact that you see claudin 18.2 in the stomach. I've heard that these people maybe have GI toxicity. What do you see?
Yeah, so this is a class effect, and it's important for everybody to keep that in mind, that these drugs cause nausea, and they cause vomiting, and it's particularly increased on the first time they get the drug. There's an element of tachyphylaxis here, such that on subsequent dosing of the drug, that toxicity is diminished. However, there's a very high rate of nausea, which, you know, is sometimes underreported in the presentations. We haven't seen the manuscript yet, but there is a significant concern for that toxicity. And to be fair, in my experience, at least with these drugs, and I've had a few of them, the standard antiemetics aren't as useful, because you're talking about something that's not a centrally mediated nausea and vomiting problem. It's a GI nausea problem. It's in the GI tract. So there are tricks of the trade to diminish the toxicity, including slowing down the infusion rate, pre-medicating sometimes with steroids and or lorazepam. But, you know, it's not as responsive, let's say, to our classic ondansetron, Compazine type of pre-medications, Neil.
What about like PPIs or, you know, local things for the stomach?
So a lot of these folks are already on those drugs in the context of their cancer. They've been diagnosed with reflux, right, at some point. There are, a lot of them are already on these PPIs, and so, you know, I think one would hope that that might help too.
Any evidence that you see greater benefit with higher levels of claudin 18.2?
Yeah, so we haven't seen all that data. The cutoff here was 75%, so that's already a pretty high cutoff, and that was a little bit higher than the phase 2 study. They had a group of patients there who were 40%. Here you had exclusively 75%. It's a pretty high cutoff. So I don't know if we're going to see gradations above 75%. But maybe we'll see that at some point.
So any crystal ball predictions of where we're going to be in a couple years, I guess? Could you imagine people getting an IO and zolbetuximab?
Well, so they're doing that study now. It's called Alustro. I'll point out they also have a second study, which we're going to see very soon in one of these virtual plenary sessions, called GLOW, which is an Asian study looking at primarily capecitabine oxaliplatin with or without zolbetuximab. And we haven't seen the data yet, but we know that it's a positive study, presumably positive for the same endpoints. Now, simultaneously with that, they're doing a study called Alustro, which looks at the combination of chemotherapy and nivolumab and zolbetuximab, because there is a little bit of overlap. It's not dramatic, but depends on what you're reading. It's somewhere around 5 to 10% of patients, and it may be higher in the real world when we get out there. So, you know, time will tell. I predict, if I had a crystal ball, that once the diagnostic is approved, we'll be testing for Claudin 18.2 and PD-L1. And then there will be this circular debate for some time about which one to use or both. But a lot will depend a little more on the granularity of these combination studies. To add a level of complexity, of course, we're hoping to add to that a la carte testing of protein-based immunohistochemistries with something called FGFR2B, which you know, we're hoping, we all doing the phase three studies now, Neil, that would also add another protein-based biomarker to the list. A lot more to come in that regard.
Right, I forgot about that. Yeah, so the Venn diagram of those three would be pretty interesting to see, but that's
exactly
really
right, Neil. It's a Venn diagram. It's not a, you know, I've been talking about this now last month. We're not going to be looking at slices of a pie like they do perhaps in lung cancer, or you know, where the crossover of the biomarkers is minimal. I think we're going to be looking more like a Venn diagram when all is said and done here.
Wow. Really interesting. So let me come back to one other thing that you commented on, but maybe you could elaborate a little bit on. So the issue in first-line metastatic of IO and PD-1 less than 5, because you said that you generally don't offer it to patients in that, and that's very controversial because, as you said, the FDA approved it in that space. What's your thinking about it? I mean, obviously, you must believe that the downside of an IO in this situation is greater than the minimal, you know, small chance of an upside. Does it matter to you whether it's 1 to 4 or 0, for example?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Number one, I have to feel good about the CPS score. So I'll be honest with you. If it's you know, if it's a cruddy CPS report, I'm feel a little bad withholding an IO in that patient, to be totally honest. So I got to feel good about it. Now, if it's good and I feel good about it and it's under 5, I have the benefit, and I'm sure some of your other speakers have benefit of having studies to put these patients on, because we recognize that the value of an IO there is minimal. Maybe not 0, but minimal. So those are perfect study candidates. That's the group of patients we should be studying in different contexts. Now, if you didn't have a study and you're just talking about a CPS 1 through 5, I think it really depends on where you fall. I mean, I personally, you know, and I haven't seen yet the comparable Pembro data with the Keynote 859 study, but in the Checkmate 649 study, if you just look exclusively at those 1 through 5s, there's really no benefit of those drugs, that drug, in my opinion. So you're going to ask yourself, is there harm? Probably not, but you never do know. And we've all been in the circumstance before where we've caused IO toxicities. So I am personally not using it in that context. I also practice in the real world. And if a patient comes in having their idea in mind that they need chemoimmunotherapy and they don't leave it up to me, and they're like, doctor, I want immunotherapy, then I do include it, to be candid, because I feel that the patients know a lot of times what they're looking for. And it is FDA approved. And so I don't feel too bad about it, to be honest. And I know that's where the community finds itself in a very difficult circumstance. And so you shouldn't worry about it too much. It's not wrong to use that, in my opinion. In an MSS patient, if we're just thinking about it logically, the addition of Nevo is a benefit for all patients and a significant improvement in the way we've treated this cancer. But it is not bringing us to curing these cancer patients. Maybe there is a little tail of the curve there, but you know, if you look at other studies, you'll also see tails of the curve once in a blue moon. So I don't look at it quite as black and white as that. I don't withhold it from patients, and I mean that sincerely. I have a patient right now who's saying to me, you know, this is what I want, and I'm like, fine. I got no quarrels with that. I don't want to look at it as I know all the answers here. That's not the way we should look at it as oncologists.
Do you entertain the possibility of using an IO later on in those patients?
Well, I mean, if you're going to do it, I think in a low CPS patient, probably the best time to do it is up front. So if you've, you know, because then there's really no data to support it. And as you know, we don't really have approvals in that context. It'll be harder to pay for and this, that, and the other thing. So I think if you want to use it up front, it's perfectly reasonable in that situation after that discussion, but I would probably do it up front.
Well, yeah, I'm really looking forward to see that GLOW study.
GLOW has a press release. We know they have a survival advantage. What'll be, we're going to see the fine print, right? How big it is and what the differences of the hazard ratios were in PFS and OS compared to the SPOTLIGHT trial. It's exclusively Asian. I think it's very validating what we already know, which is that the drug adds survival advantage in two independent studies.
So I want to talk about HER2 positive GI cancers as well, but just one final question, because this is going to relate to the issue of HER2 positive disease, which in HER2 negative disease, how are you approaching second line therapy outside of a trial?
And we don't have that many trials, and we're struggling in second line, Neil. Everybody's focused on front line, and so second line in HER2 negative disease is paclitaxel ramucirumab, and it's been that way for a decade. And I'm not aware of too many trials looking at combinations in second line, unfortunately. I think it's a missed opportunity personally to explore novel drugs. They don't have to be IO drugs, but right now pac-ram.
That's interesting. You're starting to see a lot of antibody drug conjugates coming in other cancers. Any exciting antibody drug conjugates coming in, gastroesophageal?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, we'll talk about in a minute, but the HER2 ADC space is very popular.
Sure, yeah.
Claudin 18.2 has got a few ADCs that
That's
are
right,
being developed
right.
By a number of companies, and studies are ongoing. I also personally think TROP2 is probably a relevant antigen, just like it is in breast cancer or triple negative breast cancer here, such that the ADCs are being investigated in gastric cancer as well.
Yeah, bladder
Those
cancer also, lung cancer. Yeah, that was one. That's what I was actually wondering about, like Dato, DXD. All right, let's talk about HER2 positive gastroesophageal cancer. Can you kind of provide a little bit of an overview of, first of all, when you do HER2 testing, what kind of HER2 testing you do? Do you use liquid biopsies? And how do you define HER2 positivity?
I mean, tissue biopsy is still preferred, and there's no reason not to get HER2 from the diagnosis. I mean, it makes it easier on your life, like we talked about earlier, but the implications of treatment are more in the metastatic, but certainly it's an easy test. The IHC diagnostic and reflex to FISH has been around for a while yet, so that's our standard for gastric cancer and has been. Liquid biopsy, of course, if you don't have tissue is in my opinion, pretty good. But ideally tissue-based diagnostic would be critical here. If you have someone with HER2 positive disease that is localized, as of this time, there's no role for anti-HER2 therapy. The study that we did a few years ago that was done by RTOG did not show any benefits. You can quarrel about some of the challenges in that kind of study, but there was no clear benefit in adjuvant trastuzumab. Some of the other studies have hinted at some signals, but certainly nothing that is standardized for localized gastroesophageal HER2 positive disease.
Yeah, before we get into metastatic disease, the reason I brought up liquid biopsy is kind of a thing that's interesting to observe, that I see the GI people often repeating HER2 by liquid biopsy when they get to second line, for example. And I just think I hear a lot of people, taking that information, and if they go from HER2 positive, HER2 negative, acting on it. And I wonder, we're going to get into second line therapy in a second, but just in terms of testing, I wonder if that's your practice, because it really is not the practice in breast cancer. In breast cancer, once they're HER2 positive, they're HER2 positive, even if they test HER2 negative again. But different, approach in GI cancers. Is that your approach?
Yeah, that is. I mean, and that's based primarily on a bunch of studies that have shown that for whatever reason, there is a group of patients that do not retain HER2 beyond progression. And it could be a quarter of them. It could be 30%. Studies have looked at this now in a bunch of smaller studies, but even some randomized phase 2 studies that have shown that's the case. Now, primarily that's been done based on tissue Those studies are tissue diagnostics. However, because we recognize in the real world the challenges of repeat biopsying everybody, people have gravitated to ctDNA in that context, I agree. My personal preference is still, if they progress on frontline trastuzumab-based therapy, to consider repeat biopsy when making that second-line decision. I try to do it, let's put it that way. And if I can't, I do ctDNA as a surrogate.
So let's talk about first-line therapy of metastatic HER2-positive disease that changed relatively recently with the addition of pembrolizumab. Is that your approach? You know, most of the patients in, I think it was the 811 study, were PD-1 positive, like 85%. So I don't know if they really, we really know for sure that it helps in that situation. Is that sort of your approach? You use the triplet?
Yeah. I mean, and you've heard this before. I think that rate of PD-L1 positivity in the HER2 positive group probably doesn't matter that much. So if you have HER2 positive metastatic gastric cancer, I do believe that at this time, the data supports chemotherapy plus trastuzumab plus pembrolizumab based on the accelerated approval of the 811 study. I think you can use CAPOX, you can use FOLFOX in that context. I, in that context, don't care as much about CPS score because if you look at the totality of the literature in HER2-positive disease, they almost all have a good enough CPS score. There is a codependence there between HER2 and PD-L1. That being said, I mean, I think we're all waiting to see what happens with the survival endpoints of that study and whether it'll meet its progression-free survival, overall survival endpoints. Keep in mind that it was an accelerated approval based on a response rate, which increased from about 50 to about 70. So good response. But, you know, people are still waiting for survival information. So it's complicated right now. I think personally, for right now, I'm absolutely using it in frontline.
So a lot of the controversy then is what's next? So you have the option potentially of T-DXd, but also ramucirumab, paclitaxel.
So those two haven't been compared head-to-head, but they are being compared head-to-head in Europe at this time, Europe and Asia, in DESTINY-Gastric04 study. You know, if someone's HER2 positive right now and I confirm HER2 positivity, I am using T-DXd. I am using trastuzumab deruxtecan. Based also on the accelerated approval, they have a randomized phase 2 study that showed a benefit of survival in Asia in that context. And we have complementary data in the Western world showing response rate and PFS benefits similar magnitude with trastuzumab deruxtecan. So for now, I am using that in second-line HER2-positive disease and conferring PAC-RAM to third line. At that point, you're outside of the HER2 milieu, usually.
So how about an older patient with non-visceral disease, not that sick, still T-DXd?
Yeah, I mean, in that patient, I you know, sometimes I'll give T-DXd at a lower dose, to be honest with you. Or, you know, everything's context dependent, but sick older lady, not giving full dose to DXD, you're right.
What are you seeing in terms of tolerability issues with TDXD? As time is going on, I'm hearing more and more about chemo side effects, starting out with the breast people, GI, alopecia, using a pre-medication. Is that kind of what you're seeing in these patients?
All of the above. Yep, I totally agree. And I think, I mean, breast cancer is going to lead the way here because they have so many indications now for T-DXd and they're going to use, it's going to be used all over the place. But absolutely, I think the chemo payload here causes some chemo-like toxicities. And we have to warn patients of that. Antiemetics, hair loss, nausea even, cytopenias. You know, antibody drug conjugates, by definition, have potent payloads. And this is a potent payload. And so we have to be mindful of that. That's not even touching on the idiosyncratic side effects like ILD, which I've seen a few of those. And we've all seen a few if you give the drug long enough. Adjudicating that properly is critical now. But, you know, it's very important for us to be mindful that these are not monoclonal antibodies.
Yeah, I want to ask you, of course, about ILD, but first one other issue, again, that comes up in breast cancer, which is brain mets. And the first question is, do you see more brain mets in HER2-positive gastric cancer than HER2-negative disease? And in breast cancer, it seems like there's more brain mets, more of an issue. Any data or experiences in terms of TDXD and brain mets? It looks like in breast cancer it has some activity in the brain. I don't know if it's really been looked at in upper GI cancer.
Yes, it's a good question. HER2-positive gastric cancer, just like breast cancer, is more likely to cause brain metastases than HER2-negative gastric cancer. It's not nearly as common. And keep in mind that the patients, unfortunately, don't live as long. So that may be a product simply of that. But if you look at the two groups side by side, you're more likely to have brain mets and HER2-positive gastric cancer. Now, I don't think we have enough data, Neil, to comment on TDXD's role in treating brain metastasis and gastric cancer. It simply is not as common, and it also hasn't been studied in the same manner as in breast cancer. I know that the breast cancer folks have a very potent kinase inhibitor, tucatinib, that crosses the blood-brain barrier and is an effective anti-HER2 therapy for breast cancer. The challenge is that drug has not had a very large experience in gastric cancer of testing. So I don't know if we'll ever have the ability in a large trial to have that drug at our disposal. I have a patient right now, a perfect example, who's got gastric cancer, HER2 positive, has a small brain met, 1 to 2 centimeters, not that small. And, you know, I treated it with stereotactic radiosurgery, and she's doing fine. But I'd love to give her some drugs, and she's progressed through TDXD, by the way. I'd love to give her something that can cross the blood-brain barrier. And I've petitioned for tucatinib in her case, by the way. But it's not approved. Yeah.
You're trying to get tucatinib for her. So you would, give it with trastuzumab? You know, in breast, they give tucatinib, trastuzumab, and capecitabine. Is that what you would do with her?
That's exactly what I'm trying to do for her. The problem is tucatinib is expensive and not affordable, and there's no trials that are so simple. Right now, they halted a lot of their drug development in gastric cancer, to my knowledge. So, you know, colon cancer, they have a great approval, and I think actually there, that's a big win for patients to have tucatinib, trastuzumab as an FDA-approved option now.
Yeah, they have two lines of therapy now. You know, they have tucatinib, trastuzumab, and TDXD for HER2-positive colon. Hard to believe. Getting back to the ILD, the message that we've gotten in breast cancer is grade 2 or higher. In other words, any symptoms, if they get ILD, and they're not getting TDXD again, period. Is that your algorithm in GI cancer?
Yeah, I think it's similar. I mean, you know, you never want to make the mistake of redosing someone with symptomatic ILD. So I think we're all mindful of that. I do feel like nowadays we've gotten a lot better at figuring out what ILD is and what it isn't. And we have, you know, pulmonologists who are really helpful helping us adjudicate it properly, because it can get a little tricky, especially in patients who have been in IO therapy. So, you know, I look at it as, yeah, if I'm fairly convinced that that's symptomatic ILD, even grade 2, I'd be cautious and not use the drug.
Well, you know, that belief or that, you know, algorithm that they established in breast cancer and, you know, has great activity in breast cancer, incredible, really, but is getting them to be very aggressive about diagnosing it on imaging. So if you ask the investigators, when you ask them, how often do you want to get imaging of the lungs? Even if you don't need to get it, they don't have any lung mets or anything, but just for ILD, they actually want to get it as often as they can. They want to get it like every 2 months for a long time, maybe indefinitely, because they want to pick it up before the patient is symptomatic. And again, I don't know whether that, even in lung, I don't see that kind of approach to TDXD. And I don't really necessarily hear it with the GI people, but it is because the general oncologists, they hear it from all three of you and they're trying to kind of justify it. You mentioned that you've actually had patients with ILD, with TDXD. Any serious accident, any deaths?
No, I haven't had a personally had a patient die of ILD. I've had, I'd say, grade 3 ILD for certain, and stopped the drug and you know, and a prolonged recovery. But, you know, I think that, you know, the management strategies are there. You've got a pretty good adjudication now of recognition of what is ILD and what isn't. You've got good management guidelines for management of steroids and all of the other things. You've got recognition of the toxicity, first and foremost. So I think the tools are there to help us manage this problem better. I think the differences you're seeing in breast cancer and maybe other cancers has to do primarily because of tolerance risk that you may have for individual cancers. And I don't mean that like we want more toxicity or we'll accept more toxicity. The reality in some of these cancers, and I'll use gastric cancer as an example, is we don't have the opportunity to turn to 4 or 5 other options or 3 other options like they may have in metastatic breast cancer. So, you know, we have to, as clinicians, keep that in mind. And I'm not suggesting we should just continue the drug if people are sick and having ILD, but I don't know if I would stop the drug in the context of radiographic findings that are not associated with symptoms in this disease.
Oh yeah, not without symptoms. But the problem is that, you know, if there are symptoms, even if there, at least that's the algorithm that they have. But I mean, you know, yes, there are other options in breast cancer, but I don't know that once you get out to second or third line therapy, their survival is that much where, I mean, yes, certainly gastric cancer has a very dismal prognosis at that point. But I'm sure part of that is a result of that. What do you see in terms of the future of TDXD in gastroesophageal cancer? I'm sure the trial is looking at an earlier stage disease. Neoadjuvant trials we're seeing in breast cancer. We're talking about neoadjuvant therapy. How is TDXD being studied right now in gastroesophageal cancer?
So, I mean, number one, I think people are waiting for the randomized data. So, you know, we need a good randomized data set in second line. That study's ongoing. I think the challenge with TDXD, quite frankly, is that it's a harder combination strategy. So we're not like breast cancer necessarily, where we feel that in front line, it's going to be a standalone drug. I don't know if we feel that we can replace platinum 5-FU trastuzumab pembro with just TDXD. And so efforts to combine TDXD with different chemo backbones are ongoing. But as you might imagine, as an ADC, that's not easy to do. So finding that balance between a very high efficacy that we need in frontline, which is, as I mentioned, 70% response rate, to give you a signal to lead into some big trial won't be easy. I mean, and the efforts are ongoing. And there's efforts ongoing also in neoadjuvant, to, as you mentioned. But these are going to be a little more challenging, I think, to thread that needle here.
So one more thing I want to ask you about is your thoughts about supportive care of patients with upper GI cancers. And, you know, I'm sure you have the opportunity to see many patients in second opinion who've been managed by other physicians. Any, I'm not going to say errors, but maybe misperceptions or things you see people doing in cases that are getting referred to you that maybe you wouldn't do, that you, or things that you would do that they're not doing, particularly as it relates to supportive and palliative care.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few like tricks I've learned, I guess, over the years about this. I think clinicians and general oncologists are really good at managing complex cancers, including gastric cancer. My sense in gastric cancer, and I put it like pancreas cancer the same way we teach our fellows, don't doubt clinical progression in this disease. If you feel like the patient's all of a sudden, you know, having more weight loss, symptomatic disease, failure to thrive, even if you don't see corresponding radiographic progression, it's okay to make stop therapy and make a change at that point before, you know, that performance status worsens. That's one thing that I've learned over the years. And I've also learned the importance of nutrition. So, I mean, you know, in the beginning when I was in, training, I didn't really understand that how important it is to have patients with decent functional nutrition when they're getting these chemos, and especially in disease like gastric cancer that, you know, a chunk of them have had a gastrectomy and, you know, have come in with weight loss. They start out with so much weight loss by the time you see them half the time. So, you know, we are trying, and I think every institute tries to, you know, help these patients nutritionally, whether that means consultations with nutritionists or dietitians, whether it means, you know, supportive care mechanisms to get them fed. It's so critical. You know, your drugs aren't going to work as well if your albumin's lower than 3 and you're, you know, you've lost 20 pounds in the last 2 months. And we see that very often, unfortunately.
I was going to ask you, particularly related to what you're saying about, you know, early picking up on progression, whether you do or you integrate a tumor-informed ctDNA in managing these people, or whether you would like to.
I like to, and I those are tools that I do play around with to look at, you know, ctDNA and see if changes are corresponding. You know, I think that in gastric cancer, like in pancreatic cancer, the bulk of the adjuvant ctDNA data is predictive of recurrence, quite predictive. And if you're given in the adjuvant setting, I do think in the adjuvant context, it is very predictive. And the lag time to between positivity and the development of metastatic disease is shorter. So yes, I sometimes, you know, we're not at a place in this disease yet where we're going to necessarily act on every positive ctDNA other than scan the patient and look for clinical symptoms. But, you know, sure, it's back of my mind for sure. ctDNA has been a confusing place scientifically, but more importantly for our clinicians, because the clinical data of how to react to a ctDNA positive assay has not yet caught up with the science. And until those can be reconciled, sometimes we are making our patients very anxious and confused. And I do take that in mind as well.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Wainberg, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.